present at the drafting were Lucius Calpurnius Piso of the Menenian tribe, Servinius Papinius Quintus of the Limonian tribe, Gaius Caninius Rabilis of the Tarentine tribe, Publius Tadidius, son of Lucius of the Pollian tribe, Lucius Apuleius, son of Lucius of the Sergian tribe, Flavius, son of Lucius of the Limonian tribe, Publius Plautius, son of Publius of the Papirian tribe, Marcus Celius, son of Marcus of the Mysian tribe, Lucius Erucius of the Stellatine tribe, Marcus Quintus, son of Marcus, Plancinus of the Pollian tribe, Publius Serius, Publius Dolabella and Marcus Antonius, consuls, addressed the matters that Gaius Caesar had decided by senatorial decree on behalf of the Jews, but which had not yet been entered into the treasury records. It is our pleasure that these be recorded, as Publius Dolabella and Marcus Antonius the consuls resolved, and that they be entered on tablets and forwarded to the city questors, so that they too may take care to inscribe them on double-leaved tablets. This was done 5 days before the Ides of February, in the Temple of Concord. The ambassadors from Hyacinus the high priest were these: Lysimachus son of Pausanias, Alexander son of Theodorus, Patroclus son of Chaereas, and John son of Onias. Hyacinus sent one of these ambassadors also to Dolabella, then governor of Asia, asking him to exempt the Jews from military service and to allow them to keep their ancestral customs and to live according to them. This he obtained easily, for Dolabella, on receiving Hyacinus's letter, without even deliberating, wrote to all the communities of Asia, addressing the city of Ephesus, the leading city of Asia, concerning the Jews. The letter ran as follows: In the Prytany of Artemon, first day of the month Lenion. Dolabella, commander, to the magistrates, council, and people of Ephesus, greetings. Alexander, son of Theodorus, ambassador of Hyacinus, son of Alexander, high priest and ethnarch of the Jews, brought to my attention that his fellow citizens cannot perform military service, because they cannot bear arms or march on the days of the Sabbath, nor can they procure the ancestral and customary food during these days. I therefore, just as the governors before me did, grant them exemption from military service, and allow them to follow their ancestral customs, gathering for their sacred rites as is lawful for them, and for the offerings set apart for sacrifices, and I wish you to write this to the cities. These, then, were the favors Dolabella granted to our people at the embassy of Hyacinus. Lucius Lentulus the consul declared, Roman citizens who are Jews, observing Jewish rites and practicing them before the tribunal at Ephesus, I have exempted from military service on grounds of religious scruple, 12 days before the Calends of October, in the consulship of Lucius Lentulus and Gaius Marcellus. Present were Titus Ampius Balbus, son of Titus of the Horatian tribe, legate, Titus Tongius, son of Titus of the Crustumine tribe, Quintus Cecius, son of Quintus, Titus Pompeius Longinus, son of Titus, Gaius Servilius Bracchus, son of Gaius of the Tarentine tribe, military tribune, Publius Clusius Gallus, son of Publius of the Aetorian tribe, Gaius Sentius, son of Gaius of the Sabbatine tribe, Titus Ampius Balbus, son of Titus, legate and propraetor, to the magistrates, council, and people of Ephesus, greetings. Lucius Lentulus, the consul, at my petition, exempted the Jews in Asia from military service. Afterward, I made the same request of Fannius the propraetor and of Lucius Antonius the proquaestor, and I obtained it from them as well, and I wish you to take care that no one troubles them. Decree of the Delians. In the archonship of Boadus, the 20th of the month Thargelian, an official communication from the generals. Marcus Pies, legate residing in our city and placed in charge of levying troops, summoned us and a sufficient number of the citizens, and instructed that, if there are any Jews who are Roman citizens, no one is to trouble them concerning military service, since the consul Lucius Cornelius Lentulus exempted the Jews from military service on grounds of religious scruple. We must therefore obey the legate. The people of Sardis passed a similar decree concerning us as well. Gaius Fannius, son of Gaius, praetor and consul, to the magistrates of Cos, greetings, I wish you. I want you to know that envoys of the Jews have come to me asking to receive the Senate's decrees concerning them. The resolutions are appended below. I want you, then, to see to it and take care of these people according to the Senate's decree, so that they may be brought home safely through your territory. Lucius Lentulus, consul, declares, Roman citizens who are Jews and who appear to me to hold and perform Jewish rites at Ephesus, I have released on grounds of religious scruple. This was done 12 days before the Calends of Quintiles. Lucius Antonius, son of Marcus, questor and propraetor, to the magistrates, council, and people of Sardis, greeting. Jewish citizens of ours came to me and showed that they have had their own assembly from the beginning, governed by their ancestral laws, and their own place, in which they settle both their affairs and their disputes with one another. Since they asked that they be permitted to keep doing this, I decided to allow and grant it. Marcus Publius, son of Spurius and Marcus, son of Marcus Publius of the Lucian tribe, declare. We approached the proconsul Lentulus and informed him about the matters on which Dositheus, son of Cleopatris of Alexandria, had spoken, that he should, if it seemed good to him, release on grounds of religious scruple those Roman citizens who are Jews and are accustomed to perform Jewish rites. And he did release them, 12 days before the Calends of Quintiles, in the consulship of Lucius Lentulus and Gaius Marcellus. Present were Titus Ampius Balbus, son of Titus of the Horatian tribe, legate, Titus Tongius of the Crustumina tribe, Quintus Cecius, son of Quintus, Titus Pisius Longinus, son of Titus of the Cornelian tribe, Gaius Servilius Brocus of the Tarentina tribe, military tribune, Publius Clusius Gallus, son of Publius of the Etruria tribe, Gaius Tudius of the Emilian tribe, military tribune, Sextus Atilius Serranus, son of Sextus of the Emilian tribe, Gaius Pompeius, son of Gaius of the Sabatina tribe, Titus Ampius Menander, son of Titus, Publius Servilius Strabo, son of Publius, Lucius Paxius Capito of the Collina tribe, son of Lucius, Aulus Furius Tertius, son of Aulus, Appius Minas. In the presence of these men, Lentulus issued his decree. Roman citizens who are Jews and are accustomed to perform Jewish rites, I have released on grounds of religious scruple before my tribunal at Ephesus. The magistrates of Laodicea to Gaius Rabelius, son of Gaius, consul, greeting. Sopater, envoy of Hyacinus the high priest, delivered to us the letter you sent, in which you informed us that men had come from Hyacinus, high priest of the Jews, bringing a document concerning their nation, to the effect that they should be allowed to keep the Sabbath and perform their other sacred rites according to their ancestral laws, and that no one should give them orders, since they are our friends and allies, nor should anyone wrong them in our province. Since the people of Tralles had objected face to face that they were not pleased with the decisions made concerning them, you ordered that things stand as decreed, and asked that we too write to you about the matter. We, therefore, following your instructions, have received the letter delivered to us and entered it in our public records, and we will see to the other matters you have written about, so that no fault may be found. Publius Servilius Galba, son of Publius, proconsul, to the magistrates, council, and people of Miletus, greeting. Prytanes, son of Hermas, a citizen of yours, approached me while I was holding court at Tralles and reported that, contrary to our judgment, you were treating the Jews harshly and preventing them from keeping the Sabbath, performing their ancestral rites, and managing their produce as is their custom, and that he himself had, in accordance with the laws, given a ruling on the just decree. I therefore want you to know that, having heard the arguments presented by both sides, I have decided that the Jews are not to be prevented from following their own customs. Decree of the people of Pergamum. In the Prytany of Cratippus, on the first of the month Dacios, on the motion of the magistrates, since the Romans, following the practice of their ancestors, take upon themselves dangers on behalf of the common safety of all mankind, and are eager to establish their allies and friends in prosperity and lasting peace, and since the nation of the Jews and Hyacinus, their high priest, sent envoys to them, Straton son of Theodotus, Apollonius son of Alexander, Aeneas son of Antipater, Aristobulus son of Amyntas, Sosipater son of Philip, men of worth and good standing. And the Senate passed decrees concerning the particular matters they laid before it, to the effect that King Antiochus, son of Antiochus, should do no wrong to the Jews, who are allies of the Romans, and that the forts, harbors, territory, and anything else taken from them should be restored, and that they should be permitted to export from their harbors, and that no king or people, nor Ptolemy alone, king of the Alexandrians, should be exempt from paying dues when exporting from the territory or harbors of the Jews, because he is our ally and friend. and that the garrison at Joppa should be removed, as they had requested, Lucius Pettius, a man of worth and good standing, one of our senators, directed that we should see to it that these things be carried out as the Senate decreed, and provide for the safe return home of the envoys. We have also received Theodorus before the council and assembly, and having taken from him the letter and the Senate's decree, and since he spoke at great length and with much earnestness, setting forth Hyacinus's virtue and greatness of spirit, and how he benefits all in common and each in particular who come to him, we have deposited the documents in our public records, and we, being allies of the Romans, have decreed for ourselves to do everything on behalf of the Jews in accordance with the Senate's decree. Theodorus also asked, when he delivered us the letter, that it be sent by our magistrates to Hyacinus, a copy of the decree, along with envoys to declare the eagerness of our people, and to urge him to preserve and increase his friendship toward us, and to be the cause of some good, since he will receive the fitting recompense, remembering also that even in the time of Abraham, who was the father of all the Hebrews, our ancestors were friends to them. As we also find recorded in our public documents, decree of the people of Halicarnassus, in the priesthood of Memnon, son of Aristides, and by another reckoning of Euonymus in the month Anthesterion, it was resolved by the people, on the motion of Marcus Alexander. Since we have always held piety and reverence toward the divine in the highest regard, following the practice of the Roman people, who are benefactors of all mankind, and following what they have written concerning the friendship and alliance of the Jews with our city, so that the sacred rites they perform for their God, and their customary festivals and gatherings may be carried out for them. It has been resolved also by us that those Jewish men and women who wish may keep the Sabbath and perform the sacred rites according to the laws of the Jews, and hold their prayer meetings by the sea, in accordance with their ancestral custom. And if any magistrate or private person prevents this, he shall be liable to this penalty and shall owe it to the city. Decree of the people of Sardis. It was resolved by the council and the people, on the motion of the magistrates, since the Jewish citizens dwelling in our city from the beginning have received many great benefits at all times from the people, and now, coming before the council and the people, have petitioned that, their laws and freedom having been restored to them by the Senate and people of Rome, they be allowed, according to their accustomed usages, to assemble, govern themselves, and settle disputes among themselves, and that a place be given to them in which they may gather, together with their wives and children, and perform their ancestral prayers and sacrifices to God. It has been resolved by the council, and the people that permission be granted them to gather on their appointed days, and to conduct their affairs according to their own laws, and that a place also be set apart for them by the magistrates, for building and dwelling, whatever place they judge suitable for this purpose, and that the market officials of the city take care to see that provisions suitable for their food are brought in for them. Decree of the people of Ephesus. In the prytany of Menophilus, in the month Artemisios, on the day before the first, it was resolved by the people, Nicanor son of Euphemus having spoken, on the motion of the magistrates, since the Jews in the city, petitioning Marcus Julius Brutus, son of Pontius, the proconsul, that they might keep the Sabbath and do everything according to their ancestral customs without anyone hindering them, the proconsul granted this. It has been resolved by the people that, since the matter concerns the Romans, no one shall be prevented from observing the Sabbath day, nor shall any penalty be exacted for it, but they are permitted to do everything according to their own laws. There are, then, many other decrees of this kind made by the Senate and the Roman emperors in favor of Hyacinus and our nation, as well as resolutions and letters of cities in answer to the governors concerning the rights owed to us. And from what we have set down, it should be possible for those who read it to believe our account without suspicion of malice. For since we offer clear and visible proofs of the friendship that came to exist between us and the Romans, displaying them still standing to this day, engraved on bronze pillars and tablets on the Capitol, and to remain there, I have declined to set down every one of them as both superfluous and tedious, since I do not consider anyone so churlish as not to trust us also concerning the goodwill of the Romans, seeing that they demonstrated it through so many decrees toward us. and will not suppose that what we claim to be true is untrue, given what we have shown. I have then made clear the friendship and alliance with the Romans that came about in those times. It happened that at the same period affairs in Syria were thrown into turmoil, for this reason. Caecilius Bestius, one of Pompey's partisans, having formed a plot against Sextus Caesar, killed him, and then took over his army himself and held power. A great war then broke out around Apamea, as Caesar's generals came against him with cavalry and infantry. Antipater sent them an auxiliary force together with his sons, in memory of the benefits he had received from Caesar, and because he thought it right to avenge him and exact justice from his murderer. As the war dragged on, Mercus came from Rome to take over Sextus's province, and Caesar was killed in the Senate House by the party of Cassius and Brutus, having held power 3 years and 6 months. This has also been related elsewhere. When the war that followed Caesar's death broke out, and all those in power were scattered here, and their gathering armies, Cassius arrived in Syria to take over the forces stationed around Apamea. And lifting the siege there, he won over both Bestius and Mercus, and marching through the cities gathered arms and soldiers and imposed heavy tribute on them. He especially oppressed Judea, exacting 700 talents of silver. Antipater, seeing affairs in great fear and turmoil, divided the collection of the money and assigned each of his sons to gather part of it, assigning some to Malichus, who was ill-disposed toward him, and ordering others to collect the rest. Herod was the first to complete the collection, from Galilee, of everything assigned to him, and so became a close friend of Cassius, for it seemed to him prudent already to court the Romans and to build up goodwill from them at others' expense. The stewards of the other cities, together with their households, were sold as slaves, and Cassius then reduced 4 cities to slavery, the strongest of which were Gophna and Emmaus, and besides these Lydda and Thamna. Cassius, in his anger, would have gone so far as to kill Malichus too, for he had set out against him, had not Hyrcanus, through Antipater, sent him 100 talents from his own funds and so restrained his fury. But when Cassius had left Judea, Malichus plotted against Antipater, thinking that his death would secure Hyrcanus's rule. But Antipater did not fail to notice his intentions. Rather, perceiving them, he withdrew across the Jordan and gathered a force of Arabs together with local troops. Malichus, clever man that he was, denied the plot, defending himself under oath to Antipater and to his sons, and arguing that, with Phasael guarding Jerusalem and Herod in charge of the arms, he would never have entertained any such scheme, seeing no opportunity for it. He then reconciled with Antipater, and they came to terms while Mercus was governing Syria, who, learning that Malichus was stirring up trouble in Judea, came close to killing him, but spared him at Antipater's request. So it turned out that Antipater had spared the very man who would murder him. For Cassius and Mercus, while gathering their army, entrusted the entire administration to Herod and made him governor of Celesyria, giving him ships and cavalry and infantry forces, and promising also to proclaim him king of Judea after the war. For a conflict was then brewing against Antony and the young Caesar. Malichus, now fearing Antipater more than ever, tried to get him out of the way, and having bribed with money Hyrcanus's cupbearer, in whose house the two of them used to dine together, he killed the man with poison, and having armed men ready, prepared to seize control of the city. But when Herod and Phasael learned of the plot against their father and were bitterly angered, Malichus again denied it and disclaimed the murder. Antipater, who had been distinguished for piety and justice and his devotion to his country, met his end in this manner. Of his sons, Herod at once resolved to avenge his father and marched against Malichus with an army. But Phasael, the elder, thought it better to overcome the man by cunning, so that they might not be thought to have started a civil war. He therefore accepted Malichus's defense and pretended to believe that he had done nothing wicked concerning Antipater's death, and even had a monument built for his father. Herod, arriving in Samaria and finding it in a ruined state, restored it and settled the quarrels among its people. Not long after, when the festival at Jerusalem was at hand, he came to the city with his soldiers, and Malichus, in fear, persuaded Hyrcanus not to allow him to enter. Hyrcanus complied, and the reason put forward for refusing him entry was that the crowd of foreigners ought not to be admitted while the people were engaged in purification. But Herod, paying little heed to the messengers, entered the city by night and struck fear into Malichus, who nevertheless did not abandon his pretense, but wept for Antipater and openly called on him as a friend, while secretly arranging a bodyguard for himself. It also seemed good to Herod's men, not they decided not to expose Malichus's pretense, but instead to answer his overtures with equal warmth, so as to give him no cause for suspicion. Herod, however, wrote to Cassius about his father's death, and Cassius, who knew Malichus's character well, wrote back ordering him to avenge Antipater. He also sent secret instructions to the military tribunes at Tyre, telling them to cooperate with Herod, who was about to do a just thing. When Cassius had taken Laodicea, the local dignitaries went to him in a body bringing crowns and money, and Herod expected that Malichus would be made to pay for his crime there. But the tribunes stationed at Tyre in Phoenicia, suspecting what was afoot, took bolder measures still. Since Malichus's son was being held hostage at Tyre, he came into the city determined both to spirit the young man away and to hasten to Judea, once Cassius had set out to join Antony, and there to detach the nation from Herod's control and seize the government for himself. But fortune worked against these plans, and Herod, who was quick to read the man's intentions, sent a servant ahead under the pretense of preparing a banquet, for he had in fact announced that he would entertain them all, while in truth he was arranging with the tribunes to have Malichus lured outside armed with daggers. They went out, met him near the city on the shore, and stabbed the man to death. Hyacinus was so stunned by what had happened that he was struck speechless. When at last he recovered himself, he asked Herod's men what exactly had occurred and who had killed Malichus. When they told him that Cassius had ordered it, he approved of the deed, saying that the man had been thoroughly wicked and a schemer against his own country. And so Malichus paid this penalty for his crime against Antipater. After Cassius left Syria, disturbance broke out in Judea. Helix, who had been left behind at Jerusalem with a force of soldiers, marched against Phasael and the populace took up arms. Herod had gone to Damascus to see Fabius, the governor there, and though he wanted to rush to his brother's aid, illness held him back, until Phasael, with Herod's help, got the better of Helix, shut him up in a tower, and then released him under truce. Phasael also reproached Hyacinus, who had received many benefits from them, yet was cooperating with their enemies. For Malichus's brother had at that time raised a revolt in a number of places and was holding Masada, the strongest fortress of all. Once Herod had recovered from his illness, he marched against this man, stripped him of every stronghold he held, and released him under truce as well. Meanwhile, Ptolemy son of Menneus, because of his marriage connection, brought back Antigonus son of Aristobulus, who had raised an army and won over Fabius with bribes. Marian, whom Cassius had left as tyrant of Tyre, also fought alongside him, for this man had carved up Syria into a set of petty tyrannies and held it under guard. Marian also invaded neighboring Galilee and seized three strongholds, which he kept garrisoned. Herod marched against him too, took everything away from him, and released the Tyrian garrison troops with kindness, even giving gifts to some of them, out of his goodwill toward the city. Having accomplished this, he then met Antigonus in battle, defeated him, and drove him out just as he was about to set foot on the borders of Judea. When Herod returned to Jerusalem, Hyacinus and the people crowned him with garlands. He had by now, under a formal agreement, become connected by marriage to Hyacinus's family, which further strengthened his position, since he was to marry Mariam, daughter of Alexander, son of Aristobulus and granddaughter of Hyacinus, a marriage from which he would become father of three sons and two daughters. Earlier, he had also taken a wife from among the common people of his own nation, named Doris, by whom his eldest son Antipater was born. Antony and Caesar defeated Cassius near Philippi, as has been recorded elsewhere. After the victory, Caesar set out for Italy, while Antony departed for Asia. When he reached Bithynia, embassies from every quarter came to meet him. Among them were also leading men of the Jews, bringing charges against Phasael and Herod, claiming that Hyacinus held only the outward show of kingship, while these two possessed all the real power. But Antony held Herod in high honor when he came before him to answer the accusers, and as a result, the opposing party did not even get a hearing. Herod had arranged this beforehand with money paid to Antony. When Antony reached Ephesus, Hyacinth, the high priest in our nation, sent an embassy to him bearing a gold crown and asking him to write to the governors of the provinces ordering the release, as free men and not by right of war, of the Jews taken captive by Cassius, and the restoration of the territory taken from them in Cassius's time. Antony judged the Jews' request just, and wrote at once to Hyacinth and to the Jews. He also wrote to the Tyrians and sent out an edict containing the following. Marcus Antonius, imperator, to Hyacinth, high priest and ethnarch, and to the nation of the Jews, greetings. If you are well, it is well. I myself am well, along with the army. Lysimachus son of Pausanias, Josephus son of Menius, and Alexander son of Theodorus, ambassadors, met me at Ephesus and renewed the embassy earlier concluded on your behalf at Rome, and have now earnestly conducted the present one on your and the nation's behalf, making plain the goodwill you bear toward us. Being persuaded, both by the facts and by their words, that you stand in closest relation to us, and having recognized your steadfast and pious character, I have come to regard it as a matter close to my own concern that, since those who opposed both us and the Roman people overran the whole of Asia, sparing neither cities nor sanctuaries nor keeping the oaths they had sworn, we fighting not merely for our own cause, but as it were for the common cause of all, took vengeance on those responsible both for the crimes against men and for the offenses against the gods. Because of these things, we believe the sun itself turned away in horror, since it too looked with displeasure on the pollution committed against Caesar. But their God-defying plots, which Macedonia harbored as though it were their own native air for unholy daring, and the confusion of their half-mad wickedness, which they mustered at Philippi in Macedonia, seizing places naturally strong and walled off by mountains all the way to the sea, so that the passage could be controlled through a single gate, the gods themselves having already condemned them for their unjust undertakings, we overcame. And Brutus, who fled for refuge to Philippi and was shut in by us there, shared in Cassius's destruction. Now that these men have been punished, we hope to enjoy peace for the future, and for Asia to find rest from war. We therefore extend to our allies as well the peace given to us by God, and just as the body of Asia is now recovering from a great sickness through our victory, so, keeping you too in mind, I will take care to promote what is advantageous for your nation. I have also posted edicts in the cities providing that any free persons or slaves sold at spearpoint by Gaius Cassius or those serving under him be released, and I wish you to enjoy the privileges granted by me and by Dolabella. I forbid the Tyrians to use force against you, and I order them to restore whatever Jewish property they are holding. The crown you sent I have received. Marcus, Antonius, imperator, to the magistrates, council, and people of Tyre, greetings. Since the ambassadors of Hyacinth, the high priest and ethnarch, have informed me at Ephesus that you are holding territory of theirs, which you entered upon during the ascendancy of those who opposed us. For since we undertook the war for supremacy, we have, out of regard for piety and justice, taken vengeance on those who remembered neither favor nor kept their oaths. I wish the peace deriving from you to be extended to our allies as well. And I do not consent that you keep whatever you received from our adversaries, but that these things be restored to those from whom they were taken. For none of those men received provinces or armies by grant of the Senate, but seized them by force and bestowed them likewise by force on those useful to their wrongdoing. Now that they have paid the penalty, I require that our allies keep unhindered whatever they formerly held, and that you, if you now hold any territories belonging to Hyacinth the ethnarch of the Jews, seized on the day before Gaius Cassius, waging an unsanctioned war, invaded our province, restore them to him, and that you do them no violence, with the aim of weakening their hold on their own property. But if you have any claim to make against him, when we come to those parts you shall be free to press it, since we preserve for our allies alike the outcome of our judgments in each case. Marcus Antonius, imperator, to the magistrates, council, and people of Tyre, greetings. I have sent you an edict of mine, concerning which I wish you to take care that it be entered in the public records in Roman and Greek letters and displayed in the most conspicuous place, so that it may be read by all. Marcus Antonius, imperator, one of the triumvirs for the ordering of public affairs, declares, since Gaius Cassius, on this pretext, plundered a province not his own, held down as it was by his armies, and men who were our allies, and besieged the nation of the Jews, which was a friend of the Roman people, we, having overcome his madness by force of arms, are through edicts and judgments setting right what was plundered by him, so that it be restored to our allies. And whatever Jewish persons or property was sold, let it be released, the persons as free, as they were from the beginning, and the property to its former owners. Whoever does not obey my edict, I intend to bring to justice, and if he is convicted, I shall see to it that the offender is punished according to the gravity of the matter. He wrote the same thing to the Sidonians, Antiochians, and Aradians. We have set these documents down here as timely proof of the care we say the Romans took for our nation. After this, Antony came to Syria, and Cleopatra, meeting him in Cilicia, captivated him through love. And once again the 100 most powerful of the Jews came before him to accuse Herod and his associates, putting forward their ablest speakers to represent them. Messalas spoke in defense of the young men, with Hyrcanus present as well, who was by now Herod's father-in-law. Having listened to both sides at Daphne, Antony asked Hyrcanus which men were better fit to lead the nation. When Hyrcanus answered in favor of Herod and his brother, Antony, who already felt kindly toward them, because of the hospitality his father had shown them when he himself had been in the country with Gabinius, appointed both of them tetrarchs and entrusted the affairs of the Jews to them. He also wrote letters and had 15 of their opponents bound in chains, and when he was about to have them killed as well, Herod's party interceded for them. Even after returning from this embassy, the opposing party did not stay quiet, but again, 1,000 of them met Antony, who was thought to have gone to Tyre. Antony, already corrupted with much money by Herod and his brother, ordered the local governor to punish the Jewish ambassadors, who were bent on revolution, and to help establish Herod's party in power. Herod acted quickly, for they were encamped on the sand in front of the city, and going out urged them to leave. Hyrcanus was with him too, since he thought great harm would come if they pressed their quarrel further. But they would not be persuaded. At once Romans rushed out with daggers, killed some of them, wounded many more, and the rest fled and kept quiet at home. When the populace cried out against Herod, Antony, provoked, had the men in chains put to death. In the second year, Pacorus the king's son and Barzapharnes, a Parthian satrap, occupied Syria. Ptolemy son of Menius also died, and his son Lysanias, taking over the rule, arranged a friendship with Antigonus son of Aristobulus, enlisting for this purpose the satrap, who was useful to him and who held great influence with Pacorus. Antigonus promised to give the Parthians 1,000 talents and 500 women if they would take the government from Hyrcanus and hand it over to him, and kill Herod and his associates. He did not, in fact, pay this, but the Parthians nevertheless marched on Judea for this reason, bringing back Antigonus, Pacorus advancing along the coast, and Barzapharnes the satrap through the interior. The Tyrians shut Pacorus out, but the Sidonians and people of Ptolemais received him. Pacorus also sent a squadron of cavalry into Judea to reconnoiter the country and assist Antigonus, under a commander who shared the king's name, a cupbearer. When the Jews around Mount Carmel went over to Antigonus and were ready to join the invasion at once, Antigonus expected to gain a portion of the country called Drymi, and when some met them in opposition, the men broke through to Jerusalem. As more joined them, a large number banded together, came to the palace, and laid siege to it. Phasael and Herod came to its defense, and in a battle fought in the marketplace, the young men defeated the enemy. Pursuing them as far as the temple, they sent some armed men to the nearby houses to guard them, but the people rose up against these men, who had been left without support from their allies, and burned them along with the houses. Herod took revenge for this outrage on the opposing faction shortly afterward, engaging them in battle and killing many of them. As skirmishes went on day after day between them, the enemy waited for the crowds coming in from the countryside for the festival called Pentecost, which was about to arrive. When the day came, many tens of thousands of people, both armed and unarmed, gathered around the temple. Those present held the city and the temple, except for the palace, for this Herod's men guarded with a small force of soldiers. Phasael kept watch over the wall, while Herod, with a company of troops, went out against the enemy near the suburb, and fighting fiercely routed many tens of thousands of them, some fleeing into the city, others into the temple, and others into the outer entrenchment, for there was one there. Phasael also came to his aid. Pacorus, the Parthian general at Antigonus's request, came into the city with a small body of cavalry, ostensibly to put an end to the strife, but in truth to help secure the government for Antigonus. Phasael went out to meet him and received him hospitably, and Pacorus persuaded him to go as an envoy to Barzapharnes, weaving this as a piece of treachery. Phasael, suspecting nothing, was persuaded, though Herod did not approve. Herod did not trust what was happening, because barbarians keep no faith, and he urged that they attack Pacorus and those who had come with him. Hyrcanus and Phasael nevertheless set out as envoys, and Pacorus, leaving 200 cavalry with Herod along with 10 of the so-called free Parthians, sent the rest ahead. When they reached Galilee under arms, the enemy forces stationed there met them, and Barzapharnes at first received them warmly and gave them gifts, but afterward began to plot against them. Nearby, on the coast, Phasael's party put in, and there they heard that Antigonus had promised the Parthians 1,000 talents and 500 women in exchange for their help against them. From that point, they held the barbarians under suspicion. All the same, someone reported that they were being plotted against by night, guards quietly surrounding them, and they were seized, or would have been, had they not waited until the Parthians at Jerusalem had captured Herod, for fear that if these men were killed first, he would learn of it and escape. And so things stood, and their guards were already visible. Some urged Phasael to ride off at once and not wait, and Ophelius in particular pressed him to do this, having heard from Saramalla, the richest man in Syria at that time, who was promising ships for their flight, since the sea was near. But Phasael refused to abandon Hyrcanus or expose his brother to danger. Instead, he went to Barzapharnes and told him that he was acting unjustly in plotting such things against them, for he would receive more money from Phasael than Antigonus was offering him, and besides it was monstrous to kill envoys who had come to him under a pledge of good faith, when they had done no wrong. The barbarian, hearing this, swore that none of what was suspected was true, and that false suspicions had disturbed him, and he went off to Pacorus. Once the Parthian had gone, some men bound Hyrcanus and Phasael, who bitterly reproached the Parthians for their perjury. The eunuch who had been sent for Herod had orders to lure him outside the wall and seize him. But by chance messengers sent by Phasael to reveal the Parthians' treachery arrived, and when the enemy seized them, Herod, learning of this, went to Pacorus and to the leading Parthians as though they were masters over the others. They, knowing the whole plan, dissembled deceitfully and said that he must go out with them before the wall to meet those bringing the letters, for these had not yet been captured by the rebels, but were coming to report what success Phasael had achieved. Herod did not believe them, for he had already heard of his brother's capture from others, and when Hyrcanus's daughter, to whose child he was betrothed, also warned him, he grew still more suspicious of the Parthians. The others paid no attention to her, but Herod himself trusted a woman of such good sense completely. While the Parthians were deliberating what to do, for they did not think it wise to attack so great a man openly, and put it off until the next day, Herod, caught up in such turmoil and giving more weight to what he had heard about his brother and the Parthian plot than to the reassurances of his enemies, decided, once evening came, to make his escape then and not delay, since the dangers from the enemy were unknown. So he set out with the men at arms he had, putting the women on pack animals. His mother, his sister, the daughter of Alexander, son of Aristobulus, whom he intended to marry, and her mother, who was Hyrcanus's daughter, along with his youngest brother, all his attendants, and the rest of the crowd with them, and made for Idumea, slipping past the enemy unnoticed. There was no one so hard of nature that, had he been present at these events, he would not have pitied their fortune. Women carrying infant children, leaving their homeland in tears and lamentation, and friends left behind in chains with no good outcome expected for them. But Herod, rising above the blow of that disaster, kept up his own spirit against the danger. And as he went along the road, he urged each one to take courage and not surrender himself to grief. For this, he said, would harm them in their flight, in which alone their safety lay. And they tried to bear the calamity as Herod urged. He himself nearly killed himself when the wagon overturned, and his mother came near to death, both from grief over her, and from fear that the enemy pursuing them might catch up while they were delayed by the accident. He drew his sword, meaning to run himself through, but those present held him back, overpowering him by their numbers and telling him it was wrong to abandon them to fall into the enemy's hands. For it was not the mark of a noble man, having freed his friends, to abandon them among their enemies. Forced then to give up his attempt, both from shame at their words and from the sheer numbers who would not let him do with his own hand what he had resolved, he recovered his mother, and having seen to the care that the moment required, went on along the road before him, pressing the march more quickly, toward the fortress of Masada. He fought many battles against the Parthians who sallied out and pursued him, and won every one of them. Even the Jews gave him no safety in his flight. They too attacked him, when he was 60 stadia from the city, falling upon him and coming to blows along the road. These two he routed and defeated, not as one reduced to helplessness and forced by such necessity, but as one prepared for war in the finest style and with great resources to spare. On that very spot where he defeated the Jews, he later, once he was king, built a fortress after some time and constructed a most notable palace there, naming the town around it Herodium. When he reached a place in Idumea called Thressa, his brother Joseph met him, and they took counsel together about the whole situation, what to do, since a great crowd had gathered besides the mercenaries, and the fortress of Masada, to which they meant to flee, was too small to receive so great a multitude. So he released most of them, over 9,000 in number, telling them to make their own way to safety through Idumea, each by a different route, and giving them provisions. But those who were fit and could travel light, together with the most necessary people, he took with him and reached the stronghold. And having settled there the women and those who followed him, about 800 in number, since there was grain in the place and water and everything else needed in sufficient supply for them, he himself set out for Petra in Arabia. At daybreak the Parthians plundered everything else in Jerusalem, including the palace, sparing only the money belonging to Hyrcanus, which came to about 300 talents. Much of Herod's property escaped them, especially whatever had been sent ahead into Idumea by the man's foresight. Nor did the Parthians stop with the city. They went out and ravaged the countryside as well, and destroyed Marissa, a powerful town. And Antigonus, thus brought back into Judea by the king of the Parthians, took charge of Hyrcanus and Phasael as prisoners. He was deeply distressed that the women had escaped him, since he had intended to hand them over to the enemy, having promised them as payment along with the money. Fearing Hyrcanus, lest the people restore the kingdom to him, he came up to him, Hyrcanus being kept under Parthian guard, and cut off his ears, contriving that he could never again hold the high priesthood, since he was now mutilated, and the law required that the honor belong only to men whole in body. As for Phasael, one might well marvel at his courage. Knowing he was about to be put to death, he did not regard death itself as terrible, but thought it most bitter and shameful to suffer it at an enemy's hands. With his hands bound and unable to kill himself in the usual way, he dashed his head against a rock, and so brought his own life to what seemed to him the finest possible end amid such helplessness, and thereby took from his enemy the pleasure of killing him himself. Some say that, since the wound was severe, Antigonus secretly sent physicians who, under pretense of treating him, applied fatal drugs to the wound and so destroyed him. But before he finally gave up his life, Phasael, hearing from some woman that his brother Herod had escaped the enemy, met his end in very good spirits, leaving behind him a man able to avenge his death and punish his enemies. Herod himself was not overwhelmed by the magnitude of the evils surrounding him, but they made him resourceful in devising bold undertakings. He set out to Malchus, king of the Arabs, who had received many benefits from him before, to collect repayment now, when he needed it most, meaning to obtain money either as a loan or as a gift, since he had done that man many favors. Not yet knowing what had happened to his brother, he was eager to ransom him from the enemy, and he had already paid out as much as 300 talents of coin on his account. He also brought with him, for this reason, Phasael's son, then 7 years old, whom he offered as a hostage to the Arabs. But messengers met him from Malchus with orders for him to turn back, saying that the Parthians had commanded Malchus not to receive Herod. This was in fact a pretext for not repaying his debts, urged on him by leading men among the Arabs who wanted to keep for themselves the deposits they had received from Antipater. He replied that he would go to them and give them no trouble, but only wished to discuss with them matters most urgent to him. Then, having decided to withdraw, he set off quite prudently for Egypt. At first he took shelter in a certain temple, having left many of his followers there, and the next day, arriving at Rhinocorora, he there heard the news about his brother. Malchus, having changed his mind, sent after Herod, but gained nothing by it, for Herod was already far on his way toward Pelusium. When he arrived there, ships lying at anchor prevented him from sailing on to Alexandria, so he approached their commanders, who, out of respect and great deference, sent him on to the city, where he was received by Cleopatra. She could not persuade him to stay, however, since he was hurrying to Rome, it being winter and affairs in Italy being reported in great turmoil and unrest. Setting sail from there for Pamphylia, he met with a violent storm and barely made it safely to Rhodes, after losing part of his cargo. There two of his friends met him, Saponus and Ptolemy. Finding the city damaged by the war against Cassius, though himself not well off, he did not hesitate to help it, but restored it beyond his means. Having had a trireme built, he set sail from there with his friends for Italy and put in at Brundisium. From there, he went on to Rome, where he first told Antony everything that had happened to him in Judea. How his brother Phasael had been seized and killed by the Parthians, how Hyrcanus was held captive by them, how they had set up Antigonus as king on his promise to pay 1,000 talents and 500 women, who were to be drawn from the leading families and from their own line. And how Antigonus had carried these women off by night, and how he himself had escaped the enemy's hands after enduring many hardships. He told, too, how his own household, besieged, were undergoing further danger on his account, and how he had sailed through the storm and scorned every peril, hurrying toward the hopes and the only help that lay with Antony. Antony was moved to pity by the reversal in Herod's fortunes, and, reasoning as men commonly do about those established in such high position, that they too are subject to fortune, was eager to assist him with what he asked, partly in memory of his hospitality to Antipater, partly because of money that Herod promised to give him if he became king, just as he had promised before, when he was appointed tetrarch, but much more because of his hatred for Antigonus, whom he regarded as a rebel and an enemy of the Romans. As for Caesar, both because of Antipater's campaigns, in which he had fought alongside Caesar's own father in Egypt, and because of his hospitality and goodwill in all things, and also as a favor to Antony, who was so eager on Herod's behalf, he was all the readier to grant the request and cooperate in what Herod wanted. Messala, and after him Atratinus, brought Herod before the assembled Senate, set out the benefits his father had conferred on them, and reminded them of Herod's own goodwill toward the Romans, at the same time accusing Antigonus and declaring him an enemy, not only for the offense he had first given them, but because he had taken power from the Parthians, showing contempt for the Romans. When the Senate had been roused to anger by this, Antony came forward and explained to them that it was also to their advantage, for the war against the Parthians, that Herod should be king. This being resolved, they all voted for it. And this was the greatest mark of Antony's zeal on Herod's behalf. He secured the kingdom for him, even though Herod had not expected it. He had not even gone up to Rome to ask for it for himself, since he did not think the Romans would grant it to him, when it was their custom to give it to members of the royal house, but rather intended to ask that it be given to his wife's brother Alexander, who was grandson to Aristobulus on his father's side and to Hyrcanus on his mother's. But because in the space of just 7 days, Antony obtained for him what he had not even expected on leaving Italy. This young man, Herod later put to death, as we shall relate at the proper time. When the Senate was dismissed, Antony and Caesar walked out with Herod between them, with the consuls and the other magistrates leading the way, going to offer sacrifice and to deposit the decree in the capital. Antony gave a banquet on the first day of Herod's reign. And thus Herod received the kingdom, having obtained it in the 184th Olympiad, when Gnaeus Domitius Calvinus was consul for the second time, together with Gaius Asinius Pollio. All this time Antigonus was besieging those in Masada, who had everything else they needed but were short only of water. Because of this Herod's brother Joseph, together with 200 of his household, resolved to flee to the Arabs, for he had heard that Malchus regretted the wrongs he had done Herod. But rain, falling through the night, held him back. God, when the cisterns had filled with water, they no longer needed to flee. Instead, now emboldened and more confident than the shortage warranted, since they took this abundance to be a provision of God himself, they sallied out and grappled with Antigonus's men, some openly, some by stealth, and destroyed many of them. At this point, Ventidius, the Roman general, was sent from Syria to drive back the Parthians, and after doing so, he crossed into Judea, ostensibly to support Joseph, but his whole design was in fact to extract money from Antigonus. Encamping very close to Jerusalem, he squeezed Antigonus for as much silver as he could get. He himself then withdrew with the greater part of his force. But to keep the extortion from becoming obvious, he left behind Silo with a detachment of soldiers, whom Antigonus likewise cultivated, so that he would cause no trouble, expecting that the Parthians would again come to his aid. Herod, meanwhile, had already sailed back from Italy to Ptolemais, and after gathering a considerable force of both foreign mercenaries and his own countrymen, he marched through Galilee against Antigonus. Silo and Ventidius joined him, having been persuaded by Dellius, who had been sent by Antony, to help restore Herod. Ventidius, for his part, was occupied in settling the disturbances the Parthians had caused in the cities, while Silo remained in Judea, corrupted by Antigonus's money. Yet as Herod advanced, his forces grew day by day, and all Galilee, except for a few places, came over to him. He had set his mind on the men besieged at Masada, for it was urgent to save the relatives shut up in that fortress, but Joppa stood in his way. Since it was hostile, he had to reduce it first, so that as he advanced on Jerusalem, no stronghold would be left at his back for the enemy. Silo used this as a pretext to withdraw his troops, and when the Jews pursued him, Herod sallied out with a small body of men, routed the Jews, and rescued Silo, who was defending himself badly. Having taken Joppa, he hurried on to relieve his relatives at Masada. Of the people of the region, some came over to him out of loyalty to his father, others because of his own reputation, others still in return for benefits received from both father and son, but most because of the hopes they now held, seeing in him a king firmly established for the future. A formidable force had thus been gathered, and as he advanced, Antigonus occupied the favorable positions along the roads with ambushes and detachments, but accomplished nothing against the enemy from this, or only slight damage. Herod, taking along his relatives from Masada and the fortress of Ressa, marched on Jerusalem, and the troops that had been with Silo joined him, along with many from the city who were struck by his strength. When he had encamped on the western side of the city, the guards stationed there shot arrows and javelins at his men, and some even sallied out in bands and came to close quarters with his advance guard. Herod at first ordered a proclamation made around the wall that he had come for the people's good and the city's safety, bearing no grudge even against his open enemies, but ready to grant amnesty even to his bitterest opponents for their offenses against him. When Antigonus, in response to Herod's proclamation, spoke to Silo and the Roman army, he said that it would be contrary to their own sense of justice to give the kingdom to Herod, who was a private citizen and an Idumean, that is, a half-Jew, when it was proper to give it to men of the royal line, as was their custom. Even if they were now angry with him and had resolved to strip him of the kingdom he had received from the Parthians, there were still many of his own family who, under the law, would take the kingship, men who had done nothing wrong against Rome, and who, being priests as well, ought not suffer the indignity of being deprived of that honor. While they were exchanging these words, and the exchange was turning to abuse, Antigonus ordered his own men on the wall to defend themselves, and they, shooting with great spirit, easily drove Herod's men back from the towers. It was then that Silo revealed his corruption openly. He let a good number of his own soldiers cry out about the shortage of supplies, demand money for food, and clamor to be let off to winter quarters, since the country around the city had been stripped bare by Antigonus's soldiers. He then broke camp and tried to withdraw. But Herod pressed him, urging both the officers under Silo and the soldiers themselves not to abandon him, while Caesar, Antony, and the Senate had likewise pressed Silo to stay, for Herod would see to their supplies and readily provide them with all they lacked in abundance. Immediately after this appeal, Herod set out into the countryside and left Silo no further pretext for withdrawal. For he brought in a quantity of provisions beyond anyone's hope, and he wrote to his connections around Samaria instructing them to bring down grain, wine, oil, cattle, and everything else to Jericho, so that the soldiers would lack nothing for their supply even in the days to come. This did not escape Antigonus's notice, and he at once sent men into the countryside to intercept and ambush those bringing in the grain. Obeying Antigonus's orders, they gathered a large force of infantry around Jericho and lay in wait on the hills to watch for those carrying the supplies. Herod, however, did not remain idle while this was being done. Taking 10 cohorts, 5 of them Roman, 5 Jewish, along with mixed mercenaries and a few cavalry, he came to Jericho and found the city abandoned. 500 men who had occupied the heights with their wives and children he released after taking them prisoner, while the Romans burst in and plundered the city, finding the houses full of every kind of valuable. Leaving a garrison at Jericho, the king then withdrew and dispersed the Roman army, which was to winter there, into Idumea, Galilee, and Samaria, all of which had already submitted. Antigonus, in return for his bribe, had also managed to get a portion of Silo's army billeted at Lydda, as a courtesy to Antony. And so the Romans lived in abundance, freed from their weapons. Herod, however, was not inclined to remain at rest, but sent his brother Joseph against Idumea with 2,000 infantry and 400 cavalry, while he himself went to Samaria. And after settling there his mother and relatives, who had by now come out from Masada, he set off for Galilee to reduce certain places held by Antigonus's garrisons. Passing through Sepphoris while God sent snow, and with Antigonus's garrisons having withdrawn, he found abundant supplies there. From there, he next sent a squadron of cavalry and 3 companies of infantry against some bandits living in caves, intending to put an end to their depredations. These caves were very near a village called Arbela. On the 40th day, he himself arrived with the whole army, and when the enemy boldly came out, the left wing of their line gave way. But Herod himself, appearing with a body of troops, put to flight those who had until then been winning, and turned back those of his own men who were fleeing. He pressed the pursuit of the enemy as far as the Jordan River, as they fled by various roads, and he brought over all of Galilee except for those living in the caves. He also distributed money, giving each man 150 drachmas and much more to the officers, and sent them off to their winter quarters. Meanwhile, Silo came to him, along with the officers of those in winter quarters. Since Antigonus was unwilling to provide their food, he had fed them for no more than a month, and had also sent word to those around to strip the countryside and flee to the mountains, so that the Romans, having nothing, might perish of famine. Herod entrusted the care of this matter to Pheroras, the youngest of his brothers, ordering him at the same time to fortify Alexandrian as well. Pheroras quickly supplied the soldiers with an abundance of necessities and rebuilt Alexandrian, which had been left in ruins. At this same time, Antony was staying in Athens, while in Syria Ventidius, summoning Silo against the Parthians, wrote instructing him first to assist Herod in the war, and then to call the allies to his own side. Silo, however, eager to move against the bandits in the caves, sent Silo on to Ventidius and set out himself against them. The caves were in mountains that broke off sheer, with paths in the middle that were precipitous and hemmed in by sharp cliffs. In these, the bandits lurked with all their families. The king had chests built for use against them and lowered these on iron chains by machine from the mountaintop, since the men could neither climb up from below because of the steepness of the mountain, nor crawl down to them from above. The chests were full of armed men carrying large hooks, with which they meant to drag out and kill any bandits who resisted as they were lowered. Lowering the chests, however, proved a hazardous business, since it took place over an unfathomable depth. Yet the men inside had provisions with them as well. When the chests had been let down, no one dared approach the men at the mouths of the caves, and all held back in fear, until one armed man, girding on his sword and gripping the chain from which the chest hung with both hands, went down to the mouths of the caves, indignant at the hesitation of those who did not dare go out against the enemy. Coming level with one mouth, he first drove back with javelins most of those at the entrance. Then, hooking those who resisted with his grapple, thrust them down over the cliff. Then, going in upon those inside, he cut down many of them, and going into the chest himself, he took his rest. Fear seized the rest at hearing the wailing, and despair of their safety, but the whole action was in fact halted by those who had come out against them. And many, with the king's consent, sent heralds and surrendered themselves to be his subjects. They used the same method against the caves on the following day, since those in the wooden structures pressed out against them even more, fighting at the entrances and hurling fire in. When the caves caught fire, for there was much timber inside them, an old man, trapped within with 7 children and his wife, when they begged him to let them go out to the enemy, stood at the mouth of the cave and cut down each of his sons in turn as he came out first, until he had killed them all, and then his wife as well. And hurling the bodies down over the cliff, he threw himself down after them, choosing death over slavery. But first he heaped much reproach on Herod for his lowly birth, even though the king, for the events were visible to him from a distance, was holding out his right hand and offering complete safety. With this, all the caves had by now been subdued. Having appointed Ptolemy general over the region, the king went off to Samaria with 600 cavalry and 3,000 infantry, intending to settle matters with Antigonus by battle. Things did not go well for Ptolemy in his command, however. Those who had earlier stirred up trouble in Galilee attacked and killed him, and having done this fled into the marshes and the impassable parts of the country, driving off and plundering everything there. Herod punished them on his return. Some of the rebels he put to death, and others who had fled to strongholds he reduced by siege, killing them and razing their forts. Having thus ended the unrest, he also fined the cities 100 talents. In the meantime, since Pacorus had fallen in battle and the Parthians had suffered a reverse, Ventidius, urged on by Antony, sent Machaerus to Herod's aid with 2 legions and 1,000 cavalry. Machaerus, however, having been bribed by Antigonus, went off against Herod's judgment, ostensibly to reconnoiter his affairs, when Antigonus summoned him. But Antigonus, suspecting his purpose in coming, would not even receive him, but drove him off with slingers, thereby making his own intentions clear. When Machaerus realized that Herod had been advising him for the best, and that he himself had gone wrong in disregarding Herod's counsel, he withdrew to the city of Amos, and any Jews he met along the road he slaughtered, whether enemies or friends, out of anger at what he had suffered. Provoked by this, the king went to Samaria, for he had resolved to go to Antony about these matters, since he needed no such allies as would harm him more than the enemy. He was sufficient by himself for the overthrow of Antigonus. Machaerus, following after him, begged him to stay, but if he was so set on going, at least to leave his brother Joseph behind to join them in fighting Antigonus. He was won over after much pleading from Machaerus, and leaving Joseph there with an army, he counseled him not to take any risks nor to quarrel with Machaerus. He himself hastened to Antony, who happened to be besieging Samosata, the place on the Euphrates, with cavalry and infantry present to support him as allies. Arriving at Antioch, and finding many men gathered there eager to march to Antony, but afraid to set out because the barbarians attacked along the roads and killed many, he encouraged them and himself became leader of the march. At the second stage from Samosata, some of the barbarians lay in ambush there for those on their way to Antony. Since thickets blocked the entrances into the plains, a good number of their cavalry lay concealed there, waiting until those passing through should come out onto open ground fit for horsemen. When the first men had passed through, Herod brought up the rear, and those from the ambush, about 500 in number, suddenly fell upon them. But when the first ranks had been routed, the king charged in with the momentum of his own men, at once checked the enemy, roused the spirit of his own troops, and made them bold again, and as those who had long been fleeing turned and fought once more, the barbarians were cut down on every side. The king pressed on, recovering the plunder. There was much baggage and many captives, and having recovered it all, advanced. When still more of those in the thickets attacked them, being close to the point where the road opened onto the plain, he engaged these as well with a strong body of men, routed them, and killed many of them, killing them. He opened a safe road for those who followed him, and they called him their savior and protector. When he came near Samosata, Antony sent his army out to meet him, doing Herod this honor with all due ceremony and also to give him support, for he had heard of the barbarians' attack on him. Antony was glad to see him arrive, and when he learned what had happened to him on the road, he welcomed him warmly and admired his courage. He embraced him, and having just proclaimed him king, greeted him with new distinction. Not long afterward, Antiochus surrendered his fortress, and the war there came to an end. Antony handed the command to Sosius, and, instructing him to fight alongside Herod, himself set out for Egypt. Sosius sent ahead 2 legions to reinforce Herod in Judea, while he himself followed with the greater part of the army. Meanwhile, in Judea, Joseph had already died in the following manner. He had forgotten the instructions his brother had given him on leaving for Antony, and while he was encamped in the hills, Machaerus had given him 5 cohorts. He pressed on toward Jericho, wanting to harvest their grain. The Roman troops were newly levied and inexperienced in war, for most of the contingent had been drawn from Syria. When the enemy attacked him there, he was caught in difficult ground and died fighting bravely, losing his whole force. 6 cohorts were destroyed. Antigonus, having gotten possession of the dead, cut off Joseph's head, though his brother Pheroras offered 50 talents to redeem it. After this, the Galileans revolted and drowned in the lake the leading men among them who favored Herod's cause, and much of Judea was thrown into upheaval. Machaerus fortified a place called Hetton. Messengers came to the king with news of these events, and at Daphne, near Antioch, they told him of his brother's fate, though he had already been expecting it, for certain dream visions had clearly foretold his brother's death. He hurried his march, and when he reached Mount Lebanon, he took on 800 men from the local people, and, having also 1 Roman legion, arrived at Ptolemais. From there, he set out by night with his army and advanced through Galilee. The enemy met him and, defeated in battle, were shut up in the stronghold from which they had set out the day before. From there, he began assaults at daybreak, but when a heavy storm broke and he could do nothing, he withdrew his troops to the nearby villages. When a 2nd legion arrived from Antony, the men holding the stronghold took fright and abandoned it by night. The king then hastened to Jericho, intending to take vengeance on them for his brother's sake. When he had made camp there, he gave a banquet for the men in office, and after the gathering broke up, he withdrew to his bedroom, having dismissed those present. There one could see the favor God showed the king. The roof of the room collapsed, but it killed no one it might have caught, so that everyone believed Herod was beloved of God, having escaped so great and extraordinary a danger. The next day, 6,000 of the enemy came down from the mountain heights to give battle and struck fear into the Romans. The light-armed troops advanced, hurling javelins and stones at the king's men as they came out, and someone struck the king himself with a javelin near his side. Antigonus sent a general named Pappus with a large force against Samaria, wishing to give the impression to the enemy that he was fighting from a position of strength.